It's 106 Central Time. I'm Jim Meadows filling in for Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine here on AM 580, and Jason Croft is our technical director. Plumbing is something most of us don't think about as long as it's working, and the fact that it works reasonably well is a testament to, well, thousands of years of plumbers doing their job. W. Hodding Carter is fascinated by the world of plumbing and the history of plumbing and just the mechanics of plumbing, and he's written about it in his new book, Flushed, How the Plumber Saved Civilization. W. Hodding Carter, good afternoon.
Hi, Jim. Nice to be here.
And one thing I was wondering, how good is plumbing in the U.S.? Do we have the best plumbing in the world? We are the U.S.
No, exactly. I sort of went into the whole thing thinking that we did, but we're as far as like water supply goes, I'd say probably we do. But as far as getting rid of our waste and what we do with it, I'd say we're actually behind the third world even.
We're behind the third world on average, you're saying?
Well, no, not on average. I'd say now that's sort of almost a little bit of a joke in the sense that there's just some things going on in India where they're actually using the household waste to produce energy and not wasting anything, and then treating the water so they can use for irrigating and creating biogas out of the waste, and so they're actually recycling almost everything.
Now that's something I want to ask you about a little later on
right.
in the program. But I was wondering when you look at the pipes that we have and the toilets that we have, et cetera, and just the way for moving things away from us, what could we be doing better? When you just look at your look at plumbing every day, and you must look at it differently now than you did before you started looking at this topic.
Yeah, when I first started looking, I didn't know what it was. And that was I'd cracked my main sewage line going out of my house, which is not a good thing to do any time, but especially when you don't know what you're doing. But I feel like the thing that we should be doing is people just realizing, just first of all, how their plumbing works, because it's just this thing that we take for granted that if you had to go without for just a few days even and you lived in a city, you know, things would get pretty bad. And so I think if people start understanding how it works, first of all, and then they'll understand that what sort of needs to be done with it, I think that's different than what's happening now. And the main thing for that is that not just to be treating the waste and trying to make it sort of safe for touching or for it to go into our water system, but actually making a reusable product out of it.
And you were...
I know it sounds crazy. I know people are going, what are you talking about? It's really gross. But it's being done, and it doesn't make any sense not to do it if the population is just going to get greater and greater and water supply is going to become tougher and tougher.
You, as you said, you started looking into this topic by necessity because you were working on your house and you found a cracked sewer pipe and you decided to take it on yourself?
Right.
How many years ago was this?
That was about 12 years ago. It was the first house my wife and I bought, and we spent too much money on our contractor with other parts of the house. And so I think I was digging in the basement. It was in West Virginia, and I hit. I was digging out like a old slag pile that's left over from coal burning furnace, and I was like all excited. I was doing a sort of He-Man stuff, and next thing I know, I just whacked this big plastic pipe with my shovel, and there's a huge crack, and this foul odor, and I was pretty sure that it was like the stack pipe or whatever it's called for the waste for the house, but I wasn't positive. And so then I started digging and, trying to replace it, and ended up getting into more and more problems as I went from PVC, which I didn't even know what PVC was at the time, to...
This is a type of plastic pipe, right?
Type of plastic, which is in everything. It's in everything from our dashboards to our sunglasses to, to our pipes. But and then I sort of... Then they went to a piece of concrete piping, and then it became clay pipe. And I was just sort of like, what is all this? Where does all this come from? And it just sort of made me sort of wonder about about how plumbing worked.
And you know, you're talking there about the different materials. How old of a plumbing system? I think you're up in Maine, right?
Right.
And how old of a plumbing system were you hooking into in that town?
That when that happened, that was about it was probably about a 70-year-old system.
Mm-hmm.
That went out when I was, and the funny thing was, it was no one they hardly ever replace a whole system when people do plumbing things. It's sort of a patch job, it seems to me, in any kind of renovation. So you'll have stuff going from terracotta, was what I finally, you know, eventually got down to, which is, you know, was preferred long, long time ago. Actually, in Massachusetts, some places, sometimes you actually get to wood. I mean, some people have found wood mains, or at least wood drainage lines, which was something that they had for everywhere up until the turn of the last century. And then you go from terracotta, and then you go into maybe cement or concrete, if it's drainage, but if it's supplied, it would be, most likely copper. But you might find lead first, somewhere buried, and then start going with copper. And then now with the drainage, you go actually. Sorry, I'm going back and forth. But you go from terracotta, and then you get to cast iron, and then to PVC.
So, folks all over the country. We're all dependent on drainage systems and sanitary sewer systems, which may have been laid out to a large extent decades, maybe even a century or more ago.
Yeah, it's amazing that the same lines, and we have the problem. And for the most parts, in smaller towns, I think that's not a problem. But when you get to big cities, then you sort of lots of times you have a more, closer to an aqueduct system, which is left over from really the Roman period. Not that they built things there, but we style our drainage on theirs, since they were the first big plumbers of the world, really, where the word plumber comes from is from the Roman era, from the plumbari, which are the people who worked with lead. But anyway, what happens in the cities, the problem about the fact that we still are using systems from 100 years ago or more, 150 years ago sometimes, is that when you have a big rainstorm, people hear about this, the runoff that goes into the local bay or river ends up killing thousands of fish at a time. That's because it mixes in with the sewage, the runoff water and sewage water, because they all sort of at one point had intentionally it was made that way so that it wouldn't be flooding in town. It would just everything could go out in one place.
Now, in that initial plumbing adventure, I'm trying to remember, did you end up calling a plumber or did you do it yourself?
I did it myself. I went to the hardware store and learned a lot of stuff about PVC and came back and figured out a little mind-numbed, I think, from the sewer gas at one point, but because I didn't know how sort of toxic it was. But beyond that, yeah, I think I got everything back together.
Now, despite doing it all yourself, I would say that your book says an awful lot of nice things about plumbers and the work they do. In fact, I'd say more things. There are more nice things about plumbers and flush than I usually hear from other people all year.
That's for sure.
An unsung hero, the plumber?
I think so. I mean, the thing about plumbers, I mean, one is they study their work for a long time. They have to spend all these hours essentially as apprentices, and people don't really even understand that. And then the reason why I go into this at length in the book, but I think the one of the main reasons why we have such weird feelings about the plumbers is they're coming into places like our own private bathrooms and in areas where we really don't even let, sometimes some people don't even let their spouses in the room, in that area. And they're coming in there and they're, seeing everything and talking about it with us. And I think it just makes people feel really uncomfortable really quickly. And so that's the sort of genesis of the negative feeling towards plumbers. Then we complain about how much they get paid and everything. But I think it begins more with the uncomfortable, aspect of how close they're getting to us.
Are plumbers really paid that much, and are they worth it?
Having made all these mistakes in my own plumbing, and even having some of my plumbing friends show me what to do, I'd say yes. And the price is, yes, they're worth it, but the price is high. I mean, I think that it's just startling, I think, to people. But then usually they're paying for the workers and for the insurance and everything else. So then when you take out benefits and all the things everyone has these days, it's really not as high as we imagine it is.
We're talking with W. Hodding Carter. He's the author of Flushed, How the Plumber Saved Civilization, published by Atria Books. That's an imprint of Simon & Schuster. And you can call in with your questions at 333-9455. The toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. In writing this book, you really researched the entire history of plumbing, and at least as plumbing as much as we know, which seems to be as far back as 5,000 years.
Yeah, that's it's pretty shocking to find. I mean, I didn't even know very much just really about it, like most of us. I knew the Romans had done something with baths or whatever, but I hadn't realized there was actually a civilization in the Indus Valley, which is where Pakistan is today, called the Harappan civilization. It was from 5,000 years ago. They actually had indoor plumbing, and they had baths, and they had water supply for drinking and for washing clothes, and also for having a water closet, a toilet, essentially, in every home, not just in the rich people's homes, but even in the poor people's homes, which is something not equaled until sometime this past century, you know, in Europe and in the U.S. I mean, we didn't have that here even, but they had it in this one civilization 5,000 years ago. It wasn't a flushing toilet, it was a mechanical toilet, but it did have flowing water underneath.
Yeah, what was the principle of making these water systems work without pumps and, you know, all the technology we have now?
It was pretty cool. They had these, I don't know how to say the word, but it was, it seems called a quinat, it's an underground water supply line, like an aqueduct, like the Romans had later, and they would just find a stream up in the mountains and then dig a canal underground leading all the way to the town, and they would do this by sending, you know, some poor guy down a deep hole, and he would start digging toward the town, and then set up a candle behind him, and two candles behind him, and they were placed one right behind the other, and he knew if he wasn't going straight, when he looked back, if he saw two candles, he knew he wasn't going straight anymore. So as long as he kept looking back and only saw one candle, he was digging in the right direction to bring the water, you know, to bring the underground canal to the town. And so it was just a gravity-fed system.
And it managed to work like that for a lot of people. Now, the Romans did this. Did other civilizations do it? Were there Eastern civilizations that had this sort of plumbing?
Well, these were the people from there were even before the Romans, and they were in essentially the Middle East today, and before that, actually in China, they had water supplied with bamboo canes, and I couldn't find out much more about that than just that statement, really. So I know that they had some sort of form of water supply in Asia, just as early as they did in Pakistan, what is today Pakistan. But then, when the Romans came on the scene, they in the Middle East they had a pretty similar water supply to the Romans, but the Romans then took it to a whole another level, mostly with their working with lead and making lead water supply lines, and which I tried to do myself, and had some disastrous outcome from, which I got all this lead from our local hardware store and melted it down and then shaped it into a pipe, and you know, all proud of myself. But the problem was I was breathing those lead fumes from when I melted it down, and it's pretty spaced.
How did the ancient Romans deal with a problem like that? Well, and not just ancient Romans, because lead pipe was used pretty commonly until not too long ago.
I think the Romans were aware that somehow they were aware that lead had negative effects upon them, at least when you were working it, when you were melting it down like I was doing. When you were actually, they came across it in the first place when they were it was a byproduct of mining for, I can't remember now, gold or silver, I can't remember which one it is, but they knew that when they were getting the lead off of there, the fumes made them feel weird. But they did not much more beyond that, so I think they usually just tried to do it in open air situation. And actually, when I did it, it was in the early spring, late winter here, so I ended up doing it indoors, and that's what really was my downfall. And I think ever after, after the Romans were usually working that kind of stuff with good, you know, with actually good ventilation.
Now, you know, we hear about the viaducts of Rome, but and I gather a fair amount of remnants of Roman plumbing and water systems are still around, maybe not being used, I guess, but still in, around as ruins?
Well, I mean, it's incredible. There are, the ruins are still in existence, and I know that this one major drainage aqueduct called the Cloacina Maxima, or Cloaca Maxima, depending on which version you say, was still in existence in the 1900s in Rome, still actually being used for drainage. And I'm not too sure today if it's still happening.
Now, we're talking drainage. We're talking sanitary drainage?
That was more like for runoff.
Okay, because we are talking about different types of water uses. And, for instance, your book, Flushed, is not that much about bringing hot and cold running water to people. It's about the other end, the end that people don't like to talk about, but they depend an awful lot on. Did these different systems all come together, or were some of them developed separately from each other as far as the development of the technology?
That's a great question. The drainage developed first, like the first aqueduct, the thing the Romans are famous for, and I think they're also famous for having great armies and their leaders or whatever, or their frightening leaders. They had these aqueducts really early on, about 300 to 500 years before the first water supply aqueduct that was built in Rome. There was actually these drainage supplies. They built these underground canals, lined with brick and sealed with a type of cement, making really wonderful drainage lines. They had those first, and then they brought in systems where they actually were bringing water from the mountains down. Most of the times it was carried above ground. They would also go underground with these water supply lines, and those were built the same sort of thing. They had these brick, sort of oval-shaped water supply canals done with beautiful brickwork, and then they would cement that in, and those lines would sometimes snake up above ground, sometimes below, depending on what the terrain was like. And then eventually and those would just flow into the city into like a fountain, into a reservoir and then into a fountain. And then as they progressed and their knowledge of water supply and their metalworking improved, they built elaborate supply lines made with lead pipes, and they had lead pipes going everywhere into mostly into all these private baths and public baths, but also into the fountains, but into private homes as well. And so people had water supply into their homes with usually didn't have a shutoff valve, though, because they had so much water and they weren't worried about conservation, that the water was like constantly flowing like into a basin, and it would just go out the drainage and just keep going. So there's not a shutoff valve for the water, and usually in Roman homes.
Were these sort of water systems advanced enough that they changed, where cities were located, that you didn't have to worry as much about being near a good well or being near a good stream or river for your water, that you could just count on piping it in from someplace else?
Well, some of their supplies came from 60, 70, 80 miles away sometimes. So while they were conscious of making sure it was near some of the towns they built and created, was near a water supply, they also knew they could bring it from great lengths away.
Now, these systems, we look at the ancient Romans, those systems were, are in ruins. Did we lose out? Was there a losing of this knowledge as civilizations fell and shifted over time?
There's generally, the amount that's been written on water supply and on plumbing says yes, we lost that knowledge, and that from the Roman period until sometime in the 1700s, we really didn't have water supply in Europe or even in the U.S. Once America sort of came into existence, but that's not. What I looked into a little bit further, and what other some other people have written as well, is that that's not really true. Is that the monasteries, which came and took over and filled the power vacuum they created when the Romans sort of fell, they actually kept the water supply going the whole time. But it wasn't for the whole town. It was actually usually just for the church itself and for the people in the monastery. So they actually had great water supply, like at Canterbury, at the monastery there, They had really place for bathing for everyone to bathe themselves and for to drink have drinking water and for to use as water closet, you know, something that flowed through and took the waste away. They had that, but no one else really around them did.
So for the mass of people for centuries and more than centuries, basically the standard has been that you make sure you're near a water supply, you haul your water, and as far as sanitary facilities, you dig a hole.
Oh right, I mean for everyone else, if you didn't live in a monastery, everyone else was getting water from the water man who would come with water in caskets or maybe on the back of his horse or his pack that he wore on his own back, and you'd get your water from that guy. And then you'd have called a garter robe or a bedpan, essentially type device where you put your waste into and collected it during the day, and at nighttime you threw it out the window. And I mean,
just on the street.
On the street below, and you'd yell out, and the people inside the house would yell out, you know, I guess being semi-polite, a French phrase, which sort of became sort of spoken, at least in England and Scotland. They'd say "Guardy Lou," which meant watch out for the water. But it's also believed that's where the word "loo," you know, where the British sort of slang for a water closet, a toilet, is. That's where the word "loo" came from, was from that expression.
And once it was on the street, where did it go from there?
It sat there for a little while, depending on your town and how, you know, conscious they were that maybe this wasn't such a good thing. It could sit there for weeks at a time, and that's, you know, where we get that sort of impression of the Middle Ages being, you know, a great place for the plague and nothing else. Or if you lived in a town that, you know, was thinking, or at least if you had some smart farmers, they'd come in with these, they were called night soil men, who would come and collect this stuff off the streets at night and then bring it out to the farms and use that as fertilizer.
Now, these were cities that didn't really have any drainage system, storm sewers to speak of. I mean, a heavy rain wouldn't wash this away. And
I think it would just sort of pile up into certain corners and, you know, that type of thing. Pretty much drainage was not something any of the European cities were had.
Well, then let me jump ahead to another portion of the book where you talk about, where we're in the 19th century in England, and you talk about an event which actually has a name, and this is how people referred to it, the Great Stink of 1858 in London?
That's when, that's sort of, I think, the second renaissance of plumbing, I'll say, occurred.
And this is, we're in the Victorian era now. Did London, before that time, have a drainage system?
They did. They had, well, what they had was a drainage system to take water, like water that had been in areas where they wanted to build houses and buildings and everything, like in the 1500s. They had some underground canals that took water into the rivers, and that was it. It was not for any kind of waste or even for rain runoff even. They weren't even thinking that so much, but just to get water from certain areas out of there and into the river. And then it wasn't really until this happened, the Great Stink, when the Thames was getting, the Thames was a tidal river, and when what happened was more and more people were moving into London, maybe it was like a million people by this point, I think. And they had cesspools, which are where the household waste would go into, but those would not get emptied out as frequently as they should be. They'd fill up, and then when it rained, they'd run off into these few drainage canals that existed. And then at the same time, people were developing toilets for the first time, but the toilets just flowed right either into the cesspits or straight into these drainage canals, which were just for, you know, rain runoff and for, you know, swampy areas. They weren't for human waste, you know, for sewage like that. And they would just go straight into the Thames, and it would sit there, going back and forth with the tide, not flowing away. And one summer, when it was a really hot summer, and this had been it's gotten worse and worse, the members of Parliament had to go running from the building with handkerchiefs over their faces because the stink was so great. And, you know, dousing the handkerchiefs, I think, with some ammonia even to cataract the smell. And once that happened, they finally got the picture that maybe something should be done.
And this actually led to, a major technological development as far as as far as handling this sort of sewage.
Right. I mean, they've developed drainage systems and sewers and eventually treatment plants. Not then. They didn't really treat it so much, but mostly drainage and extending it away from the town, which was, you know, far beyond what anyone else had done. It hurt the people further downstream, of course, but it got it closer to where it wasn't as affected by tide. Or really sort of
we're talking about the development of a real sewage system with drainage pipes in the streets and a main pipe taking things further away on the Thames.
Right. They pretty much tore up the whole city. I mean, they created embankments which today people, you know, go strolling on and are famous along the Thames, and created land where there are now government buildings all to house pipes and drainage and sewage treatment that never even considered before.
We're talking with W. Hodding Carter, contributing writer for Outside Magazine, author of books about the Florida Everglades and the travels of Lewis and Clark, and his latest book is called Flushed, How the Plumber Saved Civilization, published by Atria. You can call in with your questions for Mr. Carter at 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And you know, it was your writing about the London sewer system and your tour of the London sewer system which raised my interest when I saw the mention of the company Thames Water, which I guess operates the London sewer system today.
Right.
And the reason this comes a little bit into local politics, because here in this part of Illinois, in the Champaign-Urbana area, our water system is operated by a private company, American Water. They're owned by the German company RWE, but in the middle is Thames Water. Thames
Right.
Water owns American Water, not for much longer, because RWE is in the process of spinning off both companies. But it's a big political question here, because the municipalities in this area are interested in possibly acquiring the local water system. American Water doesn't want to sell, and RWE doesn't sell. But I was wondering if you had any thoughts about whether it makes a difference as far as quality of service as to whether a private company or the government handles water systems. And looking at the history of the systems, I take it all these older water systems were public projects.
Well, my knee-jerk reaction was always like, oh, it's got to be public because, you know, this is to make sure the supply is always there and there's no, you know, price gouging or anything like that. Funny thing, though, is that at first in London it was private, and then when that didn't seem to be working, they switched over to public, and I'm using them as an example, and then for about 50 years it was that, and then they switched to private again. And then for most of the 20th century, it was, I think, public. And then it went to, not to Thames Water first, but someone else had it for a while and became private again. And right now, at least I know as far as, like, for example, sewage treatment, Thames Water London has gone well beyond what anyone else was doing in the public, you know, when it was run by the government to treat the water and to really break it down to a lot of different parts so it's not wasting and not polluting the environment as much as it was. But that's being done from you know, government directives and laws and you know, pressure. So it's not like they didn't do it because they wanted to be the good guys for the environment. But they are doing things now that was never done when it was run by public municipalities. So my long answer is that it's just something that seems to go back and forth between public and private, and no one can really make it work really well as far as making money and everything goes for very long, because what happens is the infrastructure falls apart after, you know, a few decades or 50 years.
And here we're talking about, and one thing I noticed, I don't think American Water runs the sanitary sewer system here.
Right.
I believe that is public. But either way, whether you're talking about the water supply or the sewage systems, you know, after a while, you got to either keep on patching it up or you got to replace it.
Right. Same thing with supply. I mean, I was talking more the innovations they've made with treatment later and run off. But the supply, it's exactly the same thing. It can only last so long underground as it is. And so when it comes around to fixing it up, you know, people will just want to get rid of it, whether it's the city or the county or some big company, you know, to fix it all up again. It's a huge undertaking, but one that has to be done because we haven't obviously perfected, you know, something that would, this supply system.
How long can a sewer system or a water system last before you really have to do something about it?
Well, like, it depends on, and really just depends. So, like, you know, like in the north, it doesn't last too long because of frost heave and corrosion and soil conditions. But I think the parts out west, if they use the right material, I mean, it could last over 100 years. A lot of lines could, and some supply lines that we have in my town, they're made of cast iron, you know, coming from the water plant where they first treat the water and then sending it out. Some of those pipes have been there for the last 60, 70 years.
That's a good run?
Yeah, that's a pretty good one. It doesn't really go much longer than that.
Okay. Who invented the toilet?
It was not Thomas Crapper.
Well, that was the name I was going to bring up, but he was a person who worked with toilets.
That's right. And what happened, the funny thing about this is that during World War I, when the American doughboys were over there fighting, they would, the most common toilet, water closet everywhere were Thomas Crapper's toilets, because he came along after they'd been invented but perfected them, and it was a good businessman and sort of got his toilets everywhere. And so pretty much most of the ones those guys are using were ones made by his company. So they always say, I'm going to the crapper.
That's where the phrase came from.
Yeah, so that's where they brought it back with them. But and even the word that the shortened version of that word, can I say crapper?
That may be the only word you can say besides the Latin derivatives. Yes.
Right, exactly. So it's okay to say it. And it did not originate with him either.
Okay. The Thomas Crapper toilet would be a toilet we recognize?
That's a good question. No. Because later versions, the ones that came along a few decades later, by the time those guys were using them, yes, but when the ones he was making, and the guy named, I think, Jennings before him, the ones they were making they looked nothing like a toilet now. They had these sliding valves underneath where after you used it, you pulled a lever and it dropped everything down into like essentially a, you know, a trap, a bucket of water, not a trap, but like a, you know, a little pan of water, and then that would then flow out into a pipe.
So the concept of a toilet bowl filled with water doesn't seem to be quite there in the same way.
No, and that didn't happen really until late 1800s, and it wasn't common. It wasn't really common until early 1900s. And so the ones they were using might have been, you know, similar to what we have now. But the water tank would probably have been up in the high up on the wall.
Okay,
create enough head, enough pressure, so then when it came down, it could flush and flow everything out.
Well, how do we do it now? Since we don't, if we don't use gravity in that way,
just actually now it's all sorts of ways: vacuum assisted. There's still gravity, run with just having the right amount of pressure for the trap you've made, but those traps, those, you know, funny shaped back of the toilet underneath, you know, that you can sort of see from the side, looks like an S or something. Those are all designed on computers so that, you know, we've got these like 1.6 gallon flushing toilets now versus the 6 gallon ones we used to have. And when they first came out, you know, the ones made by most of the big American companies like Kohler, they didn't work.
You know, I was about to bring that up. If this is at the risk of airing our dirty laundry in public, we're in a beautiful building here at the University of Illinois, our station, built in the late 1990s, and it has Kohler toilets. They proudly say right on them, I went and checked, 3.5 gallons per flush, which is not the lowest, but it's not the highest either, and I've certainly heard complaints about how efficiently they work.
Yeah, those are the sort of earlier version of these toilets that were mandated. I can't remember the date now, but around that, I think a little bit before that point. Well, it's funny, 3.5. Actually, it was built in the late 1990s. I think you had to have 1.6.
Maybe we came in just under the wire.
Okay, all right. I won't bring that, talk about that anymore. But but yeah, those early ones, they just didn't have it right. But now, I mean, you know, they have ones that are 1.6, they have ones that are 0.8 gallons, they're made in Australia, that they flush better than the old 6-gallon ones because they design them on computers now. They do, you know, they do tests with, after they do that, then they do tests with like 100 mothballs or something like that. You know, if they figure they can flush 100 mothballs down, then they can, you know, certainly handle anything else.
Has the low water toilet gotten its reputation back yet, or do people still, you know, looking for old toilets that they can
well, it's
put
like
into their house?
Well, if you're a contractor, someone who's putting in your toilets and everything, I hear them still complaining, all these 1.6 gallons, these are horrible. But I don't know why they're saying that, because the ones that exist now really are great. I mean, they work better than anything that has ever been made before. But it's just funny that that's still left over, because it was pretty upsetting for people all of a sudden to have a toilet that didn't flush everything down. You know, when we're so used to having it, and, you know, we knew that was done because we had lots of water, and, you know, we like all this bigger and better stuff, and so we were all of a sudden, you know, having to use like a gas saving car or something, being forced to do it. Sort of like they had to get their SUVs for the Honda or the Toyota Prius or something.
The most modern high tech toilets these days not made in America?
No, they're made in Japan. Or in Sweden, or in Australia, like the ones I was just saying. You know, my favorite is this one that I sort of opened the book with a friend of mine using it. He's not very happy that I wrote about it, but it has a heated seat with this sort of coating of stuff that kills, it's an antibacterial coating that kills germs, and then it has a blow dryer built into it, a deodorizer, and then a wand that comes out and washes you after you're done.
That's a lot of technology.
It's all run by remote control.
And it works?
It actually works really well. That's the funny thing about it. The blow dryer doesn't. I have to, you know, make that clear. But everything else on it works really well. Now people are going, this is a really weird book. But once you try one of these toilets, it's hard to turn back.
Now, this brings up something that you brought up at the beginning of the hour, and this was the work of, help me here, Dr. Bindeshwar Pathak.
Right.
And he is a doctor in India who has essentially dedicated his life to bringing sanitation to poor and rural areas in India that don't have them. And I don't think he's worked with the Japanese toilet that you've talked about, but he's essentially worked with bringing toilets to areas that don't have sanitation.
Yeah, and he's, I mean, I really, just him alone makes me really happy and proud that I wrote this book. I mean, some of the things I started off writing this book were, I was amused by it, or I thought it was funny to write a book about plumbing or about bathroom habits or whatever. But when I found him and then went out and interviewed him and hung out with him in India, I was just really proud of the work he did and of what, how plumbing itself could, what a change it could make in the world. You know, you have some 2 billion people who don't have water supply like we have. They don't have sewage running away from their homes. They don't. They have to carry it out by buckets, or it goes out in some little ditch behind their house. And he's over there, and he's from there. He's a Brahmin, which is like the upper, you know, part of the caste system. And he's helping these people become untouchables, who are so low they're not even in the caste system. And he's helping make it so they can actually get jobs, either managing somewhere in a store or become actually. Since he started doing his work, someone's become a member of parliament in India from this group who, throughout the last thousands of years, their role in society was to carry human waste, to clean out with their hands and on their knees and in the stuff, clean out other people's waste. And that's all they got to do, nothing else. No one, you couldn't touch them, you couldn't have them, you know, anywhere near you if you're from other levels of society. And he's been building these toilets for towns who were still sort of employing untouchables, where they recycle all the waste and they create gas from the solids and the liquids they actually use after they treat it. They can use it to to water the lawns or whatever. And at some like numbers like maybe near 100,000 people have moved from essentially the bondage of being an untouchable to just having a normal, free life.
And we do have a caller standing in on the line. I hope they can hold on for just a moment while I ask this follow-up question. Do you think that what Dr. Pathak is doing is something that can have a real societal change in India.
I do. I think that it's not. And luckily, there are people trying to help the Dalit, the Untouchables, in different ways. But I think his way is really hands-on. It's like changing the whole system so that there's no way that their job or position could even exist anymore. And so that will just nullify that position. And so it's just a matter of time and him getting more money to build more of these toilets and the things, the work he's done.
And I want to go to our caller now. We have a call coming in from Charleston. And good afternoon. You're on the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you. This is probably some information I was interested in sharing about something you were talking about 5-10 minutes ago, which were the new systems of flush toilets. I've been at a guest house where in the tank of the potty, they have a black oval self-contained unit, which I presume is probably your 0.6 gallon. And you flush it normally, it makes a horrendous sound, but they are very efficient on the use of the water.
Does that sound like anything you've come across, Hyde?
It's sort of like the black cylinder, is that what it is? Or
it's simply a black oval cylinder, maybe 10, 12 inches long and a diameter of 6 inches.
That could be a type of, usually have two sort of cylinders in there for a vacuum assisted.
Okay, well, all I know is...
Yes, that's what makes it flush more efficiently, though.
Oh, yes. I mean, they have no filled water in the tank. It all flows from there. And as I had said before, the main problem was that it does make a horrendous noise if you don't expect it.
Okay, that's what it sounds like, then. It is one of those. Those are amazing. I actually love all the new gadgets with toilets, and that's one. Yeah, those, any of those sort of pressure sort of vacuum assisted ones that really just do the job. They are loud, but they go down. That's for sure.
Yes, I just wanted to share that there are some down in southern Indiana, and again, going back to your earlier comments about the sewage system in the monasteries. This is at a Benedictine monastery in southern Indiana.
They're always ahead of us.
I love that. That's great.
Don't know how, but anyway, wanted to share. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
For that report from the field, so
that's
to speak.
Right. That's right. Now we know that it's still happening today.
So do you think that the American plumbing scene, that this technology is eventually going to be moving in, and is there something else now in other parts of the world that we are just unfamiliar with that may show up here 10 or 15 years later?
Well, the greatest thing, I think, is what's happening at, and I don't know how the work's progressing these last half year or so, but at Penn State, they were doing these experiments where they actually were creating fuel cells. Everyone knows about fuel cells, right? Hydrogen fuel cells,
mm-hmm.
running cars, and getting electricity from hydrogen. Well, they're actually doing that from sewage water. They're actually untreated sewage water. They've created a waste fuel cell, essentially, and they were able to run by setting up creating these batteries with the wastewater. They're able to create electricity, and they were getting enough, in a really small size of a plastic, large plastic, was it 1 liter or 2 liter Pepsi bottle? They were getting enough power to run a fan, a small desk fan, from human waste.
Well, they may have to go a little further than that, but it does. The mind does reel as to what the energy potential can be in the future.
Right. I mean, if we just started just tapping into a minor amount of that, it would be great. And we have the ability to actually get a lot of energy just from trapping the gas, the methane and the sewer gas, essentially. But we usually just burn it off because, the sewage company or someone has some deal with the local gas company not to do it, or, all these different things are holding us back. But I think there's a lot of lessons we learned from what they're doing in India and what they're studying, like at Penn State, and you know, sort of what the Japanese have been doing in sort of like the local neighborhoods with treatment.
Well, that's where we're going to have to conclude. We're all out of time, but W. Hodding Carter, thank you very much for being our guest on the Afternoon Magazine.
Thanks, Jim. I had a great time.
The new book is Flushed, How the Plumber Saved Civilization, from Atria Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster.